Okay. Well, welcome to our Daily Work, Our Daily Lives. Our Daily Work, Our Daily Lives has been around now here on the Michigan State University campus for well over 20 years. And I'm very happy that my colleague and the former inaugural director of Our Daily Work, Our Daily Lives with me, Yvonne Lockwood, is here today. So what we do is we've done film openings, poetry and fiction readings with our friends Anita Skeen and Linnea Jemison. We've done exhibits. We've done a variety of different things, and we're going into the 20th year of our Brown Bag and Lecture Series next fall. So I'm just going to hand out some quick announcements, and if they start here and circulate around the room, that's great. On the 19th, after spring break, Marcy Ray from the College of Music is doing a program called Love, Sex, and Greed. I've been looking forward to using that title for years. reflecting gender and class in French comic opera. And then on the 27th, Rebecca Munich from the Ecology Center at the University of Michigan, but over in Ann Arbor, is talking from her research on labor, livelihoods, and Brazilian black gold, navigating fair trade, coffee quality, and environmental standards. And last but not least, in March, Maria Katera is coming in from the University of Michigan from American Studies and Women's Studies over there to talk about Working for Justice, Legacies of Latina Activism in Southeastern Michigan. That was rescheduled after we had her scheduled for that wonderful big snowstorm we had on February 2nd. So we're very happy that Maria can come back. And last but not least, ignore everything on the bottom except the April dates. Some of the dates up top are incorrect. But we have two more coming in April, and I'll send those around for anyone that doesn't have a copy of our schedule. Well, we've been fired up to have Lori come in for some time now to talk about both what is our new exhibit that's being put together downstairs in the Heritage Gallery. If you came through the museum, you would see that Teresa Goforth and students are hard at work on that exhibit on Alan Lomax. And Lori has been working here at the museum off and on for years, and
sounding older all the time. Yeah.
Well, and on top of everything else, she's my neighbor in Okemos, so I dearly love having Lori on the program. But Alan Lomax, along with the other kind of pioneering ethnomusicologists, folklorists, whatever kind of stripe you want to put them under, if it wasn't for them, we would have lost an entire generation or two of Michigan folk song, as Lori is really going to talk about today. Because without those recordings, a lot of that very, very important kind of background on songs and everything else would have fallen by the wayside. And a great nod has to go to our friends in the Works Progress Administration back then, who actually paid for some of the different folklorists to do their work. So today, Lori is going to be talking on the topic, and we're going to be hearing some of them in audio, competing with the bells, songs of miners, lumberjacks, and schooner men, Alan Lomax's Michigan Legacy. And would you please join me in welcoming Lori Summers to our Daily Work, Our Daily Lives.
Thank you.
Early in the season, the fall of 63, the preacher of the gospel one day come to me. He says, my clever fellow, how would you like to go for to spend a winter a lumbering in Michigan, Iowa?
Can you hear that?
Early in the season.
Good. You just heard a clip from Michigan-io, the title song for this talk and the project that is just kind of, I guess, in its completion phase, which was funded by the Michigan Humanities Council that I've been working on over the past 2 years. Michigan-io was recorded in Traverse City in Lautner's Tavern which is now the Union Street Depot. If you go up to Traverse City, the place I think probably doesn't look much different now than it did in when Alan Lomax was there. He found a bunch of aging lumberjacks, including Lester Wells, and made this recording amongst many others. Of course, this was a perfect title for a program and a series of multimedia performance events that we held across Michigan and with the Michigan-EO. It was a lumberjack ballad that actually probably came from Maine. It had many titles originally, Canada-EO and so forth. I used the most benign verse that you just listened, but I, in the interest of full disclosure, I'll just tell you what was left out in the, this is probably sums it up. For to tell the way we suffered, it is beyond the heart of man. But to give the fair description, I'll do the best I can. Our grub the dogs they'd laugh at, our beds built on the snow. Oh, God grant that there is no bigger hell than Michigan-EO. So, actually, one of the people who reviewed the whole project said, why would they pick that title, which I, you know, that song, but anyway. I only used the first verse in the exhibition, but I wanted to thank the American Folklife Center and the MSU Museum and the Michigan Humanities Council, all of whom have contributed to this project, which originally was designed to commemorate the 75th anniversary of Alan Lomax's pioneering folklore and folk music collecting trip through Michigan. And also, we are now in the Lomax Centennial 2015, the 100 years after the birth of Alan Lomax. So the exhibition, which is, you could look at it, it's still, they're putting up a few things downstairs, has the 10 panels that traveled throughout the state of Michigan, particularly to communities where Lomax recorded, and some additional objects from the MSU Museum. So that'll be up through the middle of October. So please take a look at that today or sometime later. I know you'll enjoy it. Alan Lomax was only 23 years old when he did this work in Michigan. He later became the most significant folklorist, perhaps, of the 20th century. He was a collector, a radio host, a writer, a record producer, impresario, ethnomusicologist, folklorist. He recorded and brought to wider attention these iconic figures such as Lead Belly. He had just recorded Jelly Roll Morton in Detroit, or excuse me, New York, before he came to Michigan. Muddy Waters, Woody Guthrie, Son House, as well as thousands of other performers with unfamiliar names that carried American song through the first half of the 20th century. In the 1930s and 40s, Alan and his father, folklorist John Lomax, were helping to develop the Library of Congress's Archive of American Folk Song as a national resource. They were recording thousands of oral histories and songs in their original settings throughout the South, the Northeast, the Lake States, of which Michigan was one, the Midwest, Bahamas, and Haiti. The collection at the Library of Congress is now the most significant repository of American folk music, and that's largely due to this work that Alan Lomax and his father John did. In 1938, Alan's title was something that I think all of us either aspire to or think we may be. He was an assistant in charge at the Library of Congress's Archives of Folk Song, now the American Folklife Center. So in the late summer and fall of 1938, he made his only collecting trip to the upper Midwest. He intended to visit Michigan, Wisconsin, and Minnesota, but as a native Michigander, and I know there's some native Wisconsinites here, so I will say I'm pleased to report that he found so much fabulous stuff in Michigan. He never made it to Minnesota at all, and he only had time for one recording session in Wisconsin. That was the Ojibwe fiddler Joe Cloud in Odonna, Wisconsin, in the far north part of the state. So in 1938, this recording expedition had just some remarkable results. There were 250 disc recordings made with the instantaneous disc recorder where he recorded 12-inch discs on the spot. More than 120 performers, 7 reels of film footage. And interestingly enough, for someone who was asked to do an exhibition, only several photographs. So most of the photos that you'll see in the exhibition downstairs and in this talk come from other repositories from the period. So because of this, the Archive of Folk Song for the first time contained documentation from the Upper Midwest, which significantly increased the ethnic diversity of the songs in its holdings. Alan planned to come back because there was so much that he didn't record, and he was so inspired by what he found here. But life went on for him, and he neither wrote about the trip nor published recordings from the trip. He did publish some transcriptions in Our Singing Country and referred to the work in other publications. But the Library of Congress, in conjunction with this project to commemorate his 1938 trip to Michigan, has finally digitized and put all of this material online. And I have a handout with the website, and I'll have it listed at the end of my talk today. So it's now accessible, and it's just a terrific thing. So here you see on the image on screen, he only took several photographs, and literally I think there were 3. So there were no pictures of him during his trip to Michigan, but this is one from 1939, and you can see in the foreground an instantaneous disc recorder similar to what he lugged around in his car to Michigan. And the poignant telegrams that he was frequently sending back. This one, if you can't read it, of course, says, "Please send my advance or voucher or something by wire. I'm not eating. Alan Lomax." So this is just a map from the original maps that Lomax took with him on his trip from Michigan, through Michigan and the Western UP and Canada, and Wisconsin. So I'm not going to talk about the complete trip today. I'm going to talk about more the material that he recorded from miners, loggers, and schooner men, or the sailors on the Great Lakes sailing vessels. But even if you can't quite read, you can see he started in Detroit and then went north through Mount Pleasant, Traverse City, Beaver Island. He was in Poz and Metz recording Polish traditions, crossed the Straits to St. Ignace. Unfortunately, when I was in St. Ignace giving my talk in October, I made the mistake of saying he crossed the bridge. What was I thinking? Of course, there was, and everyone just howled with laughter, and there I was sinking, but, and a native Michigander at that. And then found some of his richest material across the Straits, especially in the Keweenaw Peninsula, and I'll talk a bit more about that as we go on. I will mention that in Detroit, in addition to recording African-American music, he recorded a number of Eastern European groups and was quite taken with the fact that in the shadow of these large steel plants in River Rouge and the auto plants, he found these village traditions from Serbian immigrants who were playing gusla and singing epic songs from the 8th century, and the srivali, a end-blown flute. And he wrote about this in his field notebooks, which are also quite instructive, sometimes quite blunt, and are preserved at the Library of Congress as well. To get more to the topic at hand today, specifically regarding workers' culture, of course, one of the things that Alan was particularly interested in collecting in Michigan were ballads. And this was the great era in the 1930s of interest in ballads in Appalachia and elsewhere. And Michigan, Alan was told, was going to be one of the great sources for finding lumberjack ballads. He was later that year going to be presenting some material at a World's Fair, and he wanted, I think, to get some singers for that. He wanted some material for his compendium of American song. And he had been in contact with collectors who were already working in Michigan. One of them is pictured in the lower corner here, E.C. Beck, Earl Clifton Beck, Doc Beck, as he was known, who was a professor and folklorist at what is now Central Michigan University in Mount Pleasant. He had begun in the early 30s to pursue his life's passion, which was the songs of and lore of the Michigan lumberjack. And so Alan knew about this. He knew that there was already this rich source here. Beck was out of town, actually, when Lomax arrived in Mount Pleasant. Lomax first went to Bay City looking for lumberjack song and didn't find any, even though this was one of the great lumber ports and lumber towns in the state. So then he went to the what he called the province of Earl E.C. Beck. He writes, Beck was back up to Mount Pleasant to see Dr. Beck, who has collected lumberjack songs for 10 years and should have a machine. I will note that Alan was the first to actually record and use the latest recording technology in Michigan. A very touchy individual on whose territory I poached a bit this summer and who should be mollified and won over to our point of view. We have a little bit of internecine folklore wars being documented. I'm going to play you in a minute a lumberjack ballad that Lomax recorded, but I want to first just share with you something about the image in the upper right. This is a scene from a collection that we have here at the MSU Museum, which was given to us by Beck's granddaughter, Becky Fairman. They're photographs of a group that Beck took with dog and pony shows to schools, community groups, to the National Folk Festival, various folk festivals, the Michigan Lumberjacks. You can see an image of them here from the 1940s. Beck, in this sense, was really one of the first public folklorists, taking folk tradition and reshaping it for public performance. You can see they were wearing their, you know, the sort of stereotypical lumberjack plaid shirts. You see in the foreground a hammer dulcimer, and then there's a number of fiddles. And yeah.
Do you happen to know the river or bay that's shown in this picture?
Obviously, it's a massive log drive. The image comes from, I believe this is one from the Detroit Publishing Company, and I don't think they say. Do you know?
I would assume that's Saginaw, but it's very well made. Could be Saginaw, could be over in the sea.
So part of the collection that we had given to us by Becky Fairman were a series of rare and really exciting to have LPs that record the Michigan Lumberjack. And here is a chance to hear the lumberjacks performing, and then E.C. Beck describing the group and how we put it together.
A group of old-time fiddlers began meeting from home to home and from time to time to play old tunes of the lumberwood and sing old songs of the lumber camp. Admission to this group was gained by the applicant taking his instrument under his arm and going to the place of meeting and just sitting in. Gradually, the number grew to some 15 musicians of sorts. Of course, such a group would attract the old-time step dancers, known in the early days of lumbering as stomp dancers. These men were not professionals. They were camp entertainers who played and sang because they loved to play and sing. In the years that have elapsed since their first meeting, they have never been organized, nor have they entered the ranks of the professionals. Early in 1934, the speaker, E.C. Beck, became associated with these entertainers. They were chosen to represent the state of Michigan in the first National Folk Festival at St. Louis, Missouri. At that time, they were billed as the Michigan Lumberjacks, a name they have since carried. Since that time, they have appeared at many folk festivals in different parts of the United States, on many large public programs, including the Chicago Tribune Music Festival in Chicago in 1952, where they appeared before 70,000 people in Soldier Field.
So it's just marvelous to hear, you'll later hear the voice of Alan Lomax as well, but to hear the collectors themselves talking about their experience. Beck described once his collecting as high adventure, adding that it has given me unforgettable experiences, vigorous days in the out-of-doors, and some of the most interesting friends. Among those were two of the gentlemen that are pictured on the screen, Perry Allen on the top with the spoons, and Bill McBride, the other individual. And then you see some an image of the Michigan loggers, again, from an undisclosed location. And, of course, the songs of the Lumberjacks were the entertainment in the shanty houses during the time between meals and bedtime, or on weekends when, during the winter time, when they would have time just to entertain themselves with singing, with instruments, with card playing, and so forth. And one of the interesting things about these songs, of course, the songs were not just about lumberjacks, but that was the type of material that Lomax was particularly interested in. They sang all sorts of ballads, but I'm going to focus here on one of the best singers that I think that Lomax recorded. He was a man who was in his early 80s at the time he was recorded. The man, we don't happen to have a picture of him. This was a guy named Carl Lathrop. He sang a classic lumberjack ballad called Once More a Lumbering Go. And like a number of these songs, the songs would sort of document the story of the season of the lumberjacks throughout the process of the lumbering wintertime activity. And because these ballads are long, and we are a people that have short attention spans and are used to Twitter and sound bites, I want you to just turn that off for a second. I'm not going to play the whole thing in the interest of time, but for a little bit of audience participation here, this song has a chorus. And all the jacks would join in on the chorus. So you are going to be pseudo-jacks today, and I'm going to ask you to join in on the chorus if you were. It goes, once more a lumbering go, we will roam the wild woods over, and once more a lumbering go. You're going to have a chance to do that at least twice, if you're really good, maybe three times. And along with the text of Once More a Lumbering Go from Carl Lathrop, who passed away not long after Lomax made this recording of him. Like many of the individuals that Lomax recorded, these men were elderly. He was recorded in the late 30s. Of course, the peak of lumbering and the logging era in Michigan had been over in the late 1890s, early 1900s. So this was a memory culture for a lot of these guys. So here's one song.
Come all your sons of freedom and listen to my theme. Come all your roving lumberjacks that run the Saginaw Stream. We'll cross the Tittabawassee where the mighty waters flow. And we'll roam the wild woods over, and once
right,
more
everybody.
A lumbering go,
and
once more
a
lumbering go.
We
will roam the wild woods over,
and
once more a lumbering go.
He likes to milk it.
When the white frost hits the valley and the snow conceals the woods, the lumberjack has enough to do to find his family food. No time he has for pleasure or to hunt the buck and doe. He will roam the wild woods over and once more a lumbering go.
And
once more
a lumbering
go.
We
will roam the wild woods over
cut saws and axes, we will make the wood resound. And many a tall and stately tree will come crashing to the ground. With camp books on our shoulders, to our boots up deep in snow, we will roam the wild woods over, and once more a lumbering go. And once more a lumbering go, we will roam the wild woods over, and once more a lumbering go. You may talk some more.
I'm just like old Columbus, no regions to explore. I took a snug position, put a keyhole in the door. The keyhole in the door, the keyhole in the door. I took a snug position, put a keyhole in the door.
I don't know if you caught that, the Peeping Tom song called Keyhole in the Door. I took a snug position by the keyhole in the door, by the keyhole in the door. Or no, but I didn't. Of course, this, like the men who were in the light saving station, the Coast Guard station on Beaver Island, by the sailors in the ports or on board ship or in the lumber camps, these were all male occupations, with the guys having a lot of time with no women around. And so there's this large collection of bawdy songs and bawdy material that Lomax collected. In his notebooks, there's some really graphic lyrics that he heard that he wrote down that he didn't get recorded. But this was material that many folklorists did not record. Lomax did. Ivan Walton, who I'll speak about in a moment, did. Some of the social mores and of the time precluded the publication of this material at the time, or even the recording of it. But it's an important part of the whole songs of the lumberjacks and schoonermen. I'll just give you a couple. In addition to Keyhole Through the Door, this was sort of the most PG one that I felt I would use in my talks around the state. But there's some very great titles to some of the songs. You can just let your imaginations run wild. These are three songs that were recorded in Beaver Island by Anonymous, by Lomax, in 1938. The wind blew through her nighty, the three old whores from Canada, and my personal favorite, No Balls at All. yeah, which you can listen to those online at the Library of Congress should you desire. But this is and here you see some of the images of the shanties. In the middle of the lower one, there's a man holding a concertina. There's lots of great images of lumber camps. It's harder to find those with music in them, but this was certainly an important part of the life and lore.
My
brother sailors, I hope you're gone. To hear of the sad news, it will cause you to cry. Of the noble Johnny Gallagher who sailed to and fro, he was lost on Lake Michigan where the stormy winds blow. Oh, Johnny, my dear son, in the dead of the night, I awoke from a dream which gave me a fright. And to Traverse City I beseech you not to go, for you'll never cross Lake Michigan where the stormy winds blow.
Ivan Walton, who's pictured in the top right of this image, was to the songs of the Great Lakes schoonermen, the great sailing era of the Great Lakes, which ended really in the 1890s with the rise of what they called cinder eaters, the old freighters on the lakes, ending the age of sail. But Ivan Walton, who was a folklorist and a English professor at the University of Michigan, was and still is the premier collector of Great Lakes maritime lore and sailor song. It was his passion. He started in the summer of 1938, going to South Haven, and then followed the shoreline into a lot of homes for aging mariners, and a lot of these guys were, again, elderly. Some of them were pretty destitute, he ended up finding a motherload of material and aging sailors on Beaver Island, the largest island in Lake Michigan off Charlevoix, and returned to Beaver Island repeatedly. He went around all the Great Lakes, but Beaver Island was the place where he found the greatest concentration of songs. It was settled by Irish. The Irish loved to sing. The Irish were prominent in the age of sail. And so Walton and Lomax had been in communication, and like E.C. Beck, who Lomax later went back to visit at the end of his trip, actually Walton went with Lomax, took him to Beaver Island, and introduced him to two of his most prolific contacts that he had made there. One was a fiddler and singer named Patrick Bonner. The other was the gentleman that you see here at a much later period in his life, Johnny Green. As some of you know, I spent a lot of time researching Beaver Island myself and following in the footsteps of Walton in the late 80s and early 1990s. There were still a lot of people that remember Johnny Green. Green's relatives were up there, and everyone said he couldn't sing, which, if you heard him, I honestly tried to find, I tried to put into this PowerPoint the other version of this song, which was called The Gallagher Boys, a local Beaver Island Great Lakes schoonerman song by another islander named Dominic Gallagher, who had a much better voice, but there was some sort of gremlin, and it just, the PowerPoint wouldn't take it. So here you hear Johnny Green, who was raved about by Lomax because he had such a tremendous memory. He didn't have a great voice, but he remembered well over 100 songs and claimed to know 100 more. Many of the songs that were recorded in Beaver Island, both songs that had to do with logging and schoonermen songs, were recorded from Green, as well as other aging men and just one woman on Beaver Island. So these two professions or occupations, logging and life on the Great Lakes schooner, often intermeshed because you would be logging during the winter months and on the lakes during the summer months when the waters were open. And so a lot of the repertoire combined. On Beaver Island, here's what Lomax wrote in his field notebooks about Johnny Green. He kind of had an art of capsulizing the nature of his the people he recorded. John Green, ballad singer, knows all the songs. A mean old devil, 68. Successful lumberman, fisherman, people from Erin Moore in North Ireland. Father, mother, and uncle, all good singers. Mr. Green, in my experience, is the most prodigious ballad singer so far encountered. And he's not talking here just about Michigan. He's talking about having gone all across the American South, Kentucky, Indiana, New York, before arriving in Michigan. He sang about 50 whole ballads for me, most of them Irish broadside vintage, and he knew at least 50 more. The only reason I left the island was the press of work ahead of me on this field trip and the fact that Mr. Green was temporarily tired and a little bored with recording. From Green and his friends, I was able to attain a great many ballads that originated on the lakes, and at least three quarters of them are about sailors and ships and were much sung by the sailors. These would have been sung on shipboard to pass the time on the long run, say from Chicago north up the lake. They would have been sung in the shoreside ports, where the folklore that survived to Walton was that if a sailor could sing, he never had to buy for a drink for himself. So here is, whoops, go back. Yeah. Here is Dominic Gallagher, the other man who knew this particular song. And there's a picture here of a net shed, and I wanted to just give you a little context to where Lomax would record this material. He would record inside for better audio recording his sound recordings, and he also recorded color film footage, which he would record outside. It was silent film footage, and the idea was that he was going to put the two together, but he never quite did. This net shed is not the exact one where Lomax recorded, but he did record in a net shed, and both Walton described sitting on net reels with the smell of fish and fish boxes around, and I myself heard a story in the late 80s when I was on Beaver Island of the old guys that would be pacing the wharf outside the net shed where the recording machine was set up, muttering their songs to themselves and spitting wads of chewing tobacco into the lake. So you can imagine that. The other thing about the net sheds is some years ago I met Alan Lomax at an ethnomusicology meeting in Cambridge, and I asked him if there was anything that he hadn't written down that he could remember and tell me about his time on Beaver Island. He told me this story that he said, yes, he said, when it came time for me to leave, the islanders, and you had to take the ferry back to Charlevoix, the islanders didn't want me to go. So they locked me in a net shed with a bottle of whiskey and a beautiful woman. He was surrounded by a throng of adoring graduate students, and I beat my way through him to get this story. And he said, all he said was, I had to climb out the window to catch the ferry. So, like the late Paul Harvey, you know, you can figure out the rest of the story as you wish. But the story of the Gallagher boys was one of the great genres of disaster ballads that were sung by Great Lakes sailors. It was about a ship, a small Mackinac boat, likely like the one you see in this image here, called the Lookout, that had a reputation of being a bad boat. There were a lot of legends about it on Beaver Island that Walton later collected. And it was lost on the way back from Traverse City, just across the lake, to Beaver Island in a bad storm. So Lost in Lake Michigan was the subtitle. And Dominic Gallagher here was interviewed by Lomax after he recorded his rendition of the song. And here's how the transcript goes. Lomax, when was this song composed? It was in 1874, by a man by the name of Dan Malloy, a Beaver Islander. He was an old whale fisher, and he spent 2 years among the Eskimos up in the North Pole when he was whale fishing. Did this wreck happen on Lake Michigan? Lomax asked. Yeah, a small boat. Three men went out of this harbor to go to Traverse City for supplies. They got there all right. They left in a gale of wind. They had only a 24-foot boat, and she foundered, and all were lost. So Lomax asked, how long ago was that again? Well, it was in 73. I was born in 67. The way I remember, my father, this was Big Dominic Gallagher, left home with those boys that was drowned. And when they got to Traverse City and was ready to come back, this old Captain Roddy had a little sailing vessel there. They were good friends, and old Roddy coaxed them to stay till the next day and come home with him when it would be more comfortable. He said it was going to storm that night and they might not make it. The old man stayed. So when the boat doesn't come back, they assume that everyone was lost, including Dominic Gallagher's father. So they're having a wake for his father, and the next day his father sailed into the harbor, and wakes on Beaver Island would have been a good time. So Dominic tells Lomax with a wink, instead of a wake that night, they had a kind of a wedding. So Lomax did a good ethnographer's job where he could of recording both the songs, a little bit about their context and the story behind them. After he left Beaver Island and went to Posen to record the music of Polish farmers, he crossed the straits and entered the Upper Peninsula, where he wrote this telegram back saying, I'm getting such grand stuff, can't afford to leave. Can you wire me my salary in advance here tomorrow by Western Union? One of the problems that Lomax had was that he wrote also in one of his telegrams, folk songs in Michigan absolutely require beer. And he had to keep getting money for a little bit of money for the performers to lubricate their performance. This just gives you a sense of the places that he went, primarily in the Upper Peninsula, but the first place that he stopped was in St. Ignace. And he recorded the gentleman listed on the left who sang mostly body songs for him. And he also found another wonderful source of Great Lakes ballads and ballads of all kind from Captain Asel Trueblood, another octogenarian who had a long history of working on the lakes, and especially on what he called grainers. These boats would carry predominantly grain and later in the season and lumber early in the season. One of the classic songs, which if you know anything about Great Lakes songs, you may have heard, is called The Bigler. The Bigler was a timber drogher, they called it, a timber boat that had kind of a square bottom. It was a clumsy boat, but it could get through the canals. It could fit long, long timbers. This particular ballad, The Bigler, talks about its trip from Milwaukee to Buffalo, another one of the Great Lakes ballads that Lomax collected. And this was just a really inefficient, clumsy, slow boat. And there were the fast grainers with their sails that were whipping past it. And this particular, here's a little bit of April 2.
On the Sunday morning, just at the hour of 10, when the tug Knickerbocker towed the schooner Bigler into Lake Michigan. Oh, there we made our canvas in the middle of the fleet, and the wind hauled to the southern boys. Oh, we had together sheet. Watch her, catch her, jump up in her jubber-jew. Give her sheet and let her go, or the lad will put her through. And don't you hear it howling? Oh, the wind is blowing free on our down trip to Buffalo from Milwaukee.
Minasidudessa, aua monken tjussa toimien. Ja häntelistä pyörittää san kautta voimien. Minun nimeni on maina riityön arvo muukahan. On parempi kuin lanterit, ei kiellä kuukahan.
You were listening to a little bit of a mining song, one of the very few that Lomax recorded on his trip in 1938. Whereas the lumberjacks and the schoonermen were quite prolific in producing songs, you can well imagine that the context of, you know, of a lumber camp at night or on board ship is much different than being underground in a mine working with loud equipment. And so the miners did not have the same kind of material. He recorded a lot in mining country of other kinds of songs, immigrant songs, dance songs, instrumental music. But this is one of the few mining songs. It's an interesting song because, like all of these occupational songs, you get a perspective, sort of a folk history of the view of the workers of their own occupation. A lot of the terminology of the occupation, particularly amongst lumberjacks, and some of the antipathies in the case between the schoonermen and the cinder eaters, those on the early freighters, or different lumber camps, different the exploits of different loggers. Here you have the first verse, which is translated from the Finnish. The second verse is quite evocative of some of these conflicts between occupations. So the miner has his pride that men working above ground can't understand how those pretty boys, porridge eaters, lumberjacks, as far as we're concerned, they're just a bunch of milksops. So here's Frank Mackey's song about the superiority of miners. Again, these kinds of songs were quite rare. What Lomax did do is record, again, these quite evocative descriptions about what he found in these different communities in his field journals. So he writes about another miner that he encountered on the streets of Amasa, which, and this is what he has to say. On Amasa Street one morning, I passed this fellow. When I turned to look at him, he said, "I've been walking all night." Without waiting for me to answer, he said, "Yes, walking all night. Didn't sleep an hour. Had to keep these fingers going." And he showed me his hands curled up like bird's feet, gripping a perch that wasn't there. "Got this way in the mines," he went on. "We was cleaning out old Farley Jones' hole, and I was foreman, and they wouldn't give us a stove to dry our clothes out. It was wet in there, you know, and we hauled out the old machinery. I asked the boss for a stove, and he wouldn't give us one. We'd take our clothes off at night, and when we come to put them on in the morning, they'd be froze. Well, a little while of that, and I couldn't turn my neck, and three of the other men died by consumption. I didn't die right away, but I've been dying by inches for the last 19 years. So you get a feel here for the reason why there was a rise for need for unionization and worker organizing, which had not been successful, but was clearly needed at this time in these mines in the UP. So a rare mining song, mostly in Amasa he recorded instrumental music, but he did record this one song. When he was in the Keweenaw, this is where he recorded a number of wonderful segments on his color film movie camera. This is probably why he didn't have very many photographs, because he had his instantaneous disc recorder, he had a movie camera. He probably had enough to do without taking pictures as well. You see some of the images of individuals that he recorded and the instruments that he recorded against the backdrop of the copper mining industry of the Keweenaw Peninsula. In the Keweenaw, he did record one excerpt that has to do with mining, and I wanted to play that for you. It's a wonderful song called the 37th Level Blues, talking about the level of down underground, sung by a Croatian family, the Florianis, whose sons were attending Duquesne University and had been part of its famous tamburica. And so the next segment is also a tamburica. This is the restored Alan Lomax film footage. You see images of the mining country.
From my head down to my shoes, in the morning I wolf around, in the evening by the stars I frown. When the boss comes round and says, "Get up, don't stall around, show some sense, try to keep your rest. Work makes my back ache, and the day is head on straight.
Music being played by Vladimir Floriani and his two sons, Vladimir Jr. and Zeko.
Those of you who know the Keweenaw Peninsula would recognize that iconic image, looking up and seeing the, what is that called, the canal? What do you call that?
Portage Canal.
Portage Canal, right. One of the extraordinary things about this film is that until, again, I mentioned that they, my colleagues Jim Leary at the University of Wisconsin and Guha Shankar at the Library of Congress have worked to restore this film. I'm going to show you a longer excerpt just at the very beginning of it, just here to close. But it was, again, silent. And so what they did is take the sound recordings and try and find the ones that fit. with this film footage. And again, we had to also try and translate this material. They worked with a lot of colleagues to translate all the different languages that were sung in the recordings and in the to go with the film. And actually, for many years until they actually looked and began to restore this, they thought that this was black and white film. And when they began to actually play it and work with it, they discovered it was this wonderful early color film image. So here is the website for those of you who are interested, or you can just Google Alan Lomax recordings from Michigan and Wisconsin, and all of the original field recordings are available. The film is going to be available, the restored film, as part of a 5-CD or multimedia set that will come out later this year from University of Wisconsin that my colleague Jim Leary has been doing the entire, including one CD of selected recordings from Michigan called Folk Songs of Another America, Field Recordings from the Upper Midwest. But I'd like to show you just a little bit. Let me see if I can. Of the. All right, where did it go? It's supposed to be here. Oh, there we are. Of the film footage. And actually, Jim Leary, a native Wisconsinite from Rice Lake, not surprisingly, snuck in this film footage from 1938 in May of the Wisconsin Lumberjacks, the rival group that was started by, I'm spacing out on his name right now, Rindlisbacher, who was from Rice Lake, where Jim actually was raised as well. And he, there are a number of unusual instruments here that were created by lumberjack musicians in Wisconsin. You'll see the cigar box fiddle and the Viking cello, which was a cigar box, a pitchfork, and a tree branch, a bass made from a garbage pan. And these, like the Michigan lumberjacks, were also taken around to various folk festivals. So it'll give you a sense of another occupational tradition. And I'm just going to show you.
To swamp for a gold devil we begun. 'Twas on the banks of the Eau Claire. We landed there when the ground was bare.
Based on what you've seen in the lumber camp for the lumberjacks and the performance. Seattle's wife. The beginning of the Michigan film.
Dear sir, the Archive of American Folk Song plans a rapid recording survey of Michigan, Wisconsin, and Minnesota during the summer. If you know of the location of any Yugoslavian barotto blowers or any Swiss shanty singers, I would greatly appreciate your calling me by long distance before morning. By the middle of September, I hope to be speaking an interesting dialect composed of Norwegian, Swedish, Icelandic, German, Canuck, Hungarian, Finnic, Polish, Russian, and Oshkosh.
This was a joke, but...
This record is being made in Clear Point, Michigan, on the outskirts of Detroit, August the 5th, 1938. The section here is almost solidly Serbian. In the shadow of the Chrysler plant, you find the Serbians still playing their native shepherd's flute and the guzla.
Iz Bosne, Fajo Tomić. Hoću da vam zapjevam jednu od srpskoga boja.
U 1912. Momže to je godine, je se zjaše na doma kuzine. Braću svoju rosva da spasava.
In the interest of time, I'm just going to stop it there, but the entire film is downstairs as part of the exhibit. It's 27 minutes long, and what happened was he recorded the Serbians in Detroit, and then all of what he must have recorded in the rest of the Lower Peninsula and the Eastern Upper Peninsula were stolen in the Keweenaw. So what we have left for the remaining portion of the color film footage is footage that he made of French Canadians, Finns. You saw the bit with the Floriani family in the Keweenaw Peninsula and a little bit west in Ontonagon. I just wanted to close with some of the firsts that came out of Alan Lomax's 1938 Michigan recordings. It was the first survey of the breadth of Michigan folk music. It was just 10 weeks, but 10 languages, 13 different ethnic groups, including French Canadian, Polish, Hungarian, Romanian, Ojibwa, Irish, Swedish, Croatian, Italian, German, Serbian, Bosnian, African American, Lithuanian, and Anglo-American. It was, as I mentioned before, the first use of the new recording technology. So these are the earliest recordings that we have of traditional music in the state. And in addition to recording a large number of ballads sung in English, the majority of which I've played for you, although you heard the Finnish language and the Croatian material, he recorded a lot of mixing and blending of traditions, which is really the nature of much of traditional culture in Michigan. And he was really the first to do that. It's not clear that he really knew that he was doing that or what he was recording. He had to depend upon cultural brokers, people to help translate and introduce him to these communities. especially in certain places in Posen, for example, there, most of what was spoken to him was in Polish. And that was a source of some frustration to him. But when you look at the body of the work, you have this amazing ethnic diversity, which, as I mentioned, was really for the first time that was represented, because the culture of the upper Midwest was so different from the American South, where he had been recording, and remains such a rich region with the mixture of all these different cultural communities coming together and creating new hybrid and forms that have really shaped our musical culture today. And so we're building here at the MSC Museum with recordings and fieldwork that has been done since on the footsteps that were laid by Alan Lomax and, of course, by the great Michigan collectors as well, particularly Ivan Walton and E.C. Beck. So thank you very much for being here, and if anybody has any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Well, a tour de force, and right here with the first question.
Lauren?
Yes.
What
one do you know?
Okay. Well, I wanted to explain. One of the things I do, my name is Gary Gelch. One of the things I do is I'm a volunteer docent at the Michigan Historical Museum. And we have a program there called Big History, where kids come from an elementary school and they stay in there all week long. And they go through all these different programs. And so one of the things I do,
thank you. If you go to Hartwick Pines State Park and their logging museum there, they have a wonderful recreation of a logging camp. If you haven't been there lately, it's well worth a stop. Anybody have any other questions?
Other questions? Yes, Michael.
Yeah, Michael. You know, that's an excellent question, because I haven't been on the website. They would definitely be that way. It would be worth looking to see if they've, I know that they've digitized a number of the field notes. I haven't seen all of them. I know if anybody's interested, by the way, I have a few handouts of just resources about Michigan and Lomax in 1938, in addition to the website. I know that some of the field notes are included in this wonderful e-book that Todd Harvey, the Lomax curator at the Library of Congress, did called Michigan-io. That's where I got, you know, he did it too. Alan Lomax and the 1938 Library of Congress Folk Song Expedition. They are in the process of digitizing all of that. And I don't believe all of that's on the website just yet, but they are accessible. I believe it's coming because I've seen some of it, along with these letters and telegrams that he sent back imploring for, you know, money, and also his recording machine was, he didn't have great luck. His recording machine was stolen in Detroit within his very first week here in Michigan. One might think that's a stereotype, as you know, this unjust, but one might think that, but then you know that his, you know, his movie footage was stolen in the Keweenaw Peninsula, so each peninsula has its piece in this.
Jim?
When you think of the roots of the blues, those being Normandy, Mississippi, Delta country, and yet what struck me powerfully listening to these songs is that here's what looks like it could be an independent group of a parallel blues tradition. These lumberjacks would not have known about, you know, African American prisoners in the area of Clarksdale, Mississippi. Have you done or had any thoughts about this as, you know, let's say Upper Midwest? I don't want to be too chauvinistic about Michigan, but the Upper Midwest as a source of a parallel blues tradition.
Well, I guess I would answer that in two ways. I think that the lumberjack material and the schoonerman material really comes out of the Anglo-American ballad tradition. However, there were black stevedores that Ivan Walton recorded. There were African Americans in the mines and some, you know, in the logging industry as well, not nearly the numbers that, but I think that by and large is a separate tradition. However, there would have been, you know, some intermingling in terms of working, but a lot of what Lomax recorded was foreign language material that was, you know, and this English language material that comes out of this Anglo-American ballad tradition, and he was particularly interested in that, not so much in the ethnic material, but he ended up getting a lot of it, and that's what makes his collection so interesting. In terms of the parallel tradition of blues, what I didn't do in this talk because of the topics of workers' culture, but what I have done in my other presentations on this, the Lomax trip in Michigan, was that he started in Detroit and was driving around within the first few days there and came across what he described as two of one of the best bluesmen that he'd encountered, and this is another plug for Michigan in the Upper Midwest. This was a man who had his roots in Arkansas and Tennessee, and came up like many African Americans did to Michigan. A man by the name of Calvin Frazier, but who was accompanied by a guy named Samson Pittman, who's, I believe it's his son, Samson Pittman II, that still lives in Saginaw and had a career as a bluesman himself, but doesn't want to talk to us because I think he wants money for his father's recordings. But at any rate, they came up and Lomax recorded him and was sort of regaling in his notes about how this man was such one of the best bluesmen that he had encountered. And again, here's someone that had just finished going across the American South with his father and on his own recording. So there was a blues tradition, as you well know, here in the state. But I don't think that the lumbering tradition that, you know, is related to that.
Let me just ask a question, and then go back to David in the corner. But isn't by this time? I mean, because that 31st level blues.
Well, that one does.
That
one has a popular. We're all trying to. If anyone recognizes that tune, it's been driving us nuts.
By this time, though, I mean after the turn of the 20th century, we're already into actual recordings that people are buying. And
right.
You're also, I mean, sheet music was a huge business in this period. So, I mean, there's a certain amount of cross-fertilization. It's not like these folks were totally without resources in relation to being able to get things.
Absolutely. And I wouldn't deny that. But you also need to remember that, with some exceptions, that what Lomax, Beck, and Walton were all looking for was really late 19th century material. Mm-hmm. And they were recording it from men who, at best, were in their 60s, and many times were older than that. And so it comes from a tradition where you would have, which was more oral in its base, more occupational, so that there isn't going to be, I mean, in Posen, in the midst of all this Polish material, they recorded these two sisters singing Gold Mine in the Sky, which was the theme that Gene Autry sang in a movie of the same title that year. So there was certainly, you know, things that were topical, and but what he was really interested in was this older material before the age of recording. And,
well, I'm just pointing out that I guess even if he's interested in the older material, the idea that there was a certain amount of cross-fertilization. I mean, by this time, the amount of church music that makes its way into the labor movement before the turn of the 20th century and definitely in the IWW period is very large.
Right.
And a lot of these guys actually live in town. That is, many of the lumberjacks actually lived, for example, in places like Escanaba or Munising or whatever, so that they had the ability to either tap into church stuff or whatever.
It's possible.
Yeah.
I don't think that's the most likely explanation. But
David, back and then down here to Neil.
I think one thing when he mentioned with your possible connection with blues possibly developing outside, very often in certain scale patterns of music from other countries, there is somewhat of a similar blues pattern. Do you see blues? And you see this in Serbian music, you see it in some maybe possible thin music, but there is a possible that pattern of minor third followed by major second, and then there's that fourth, which always tends to throw in a blues type thing that's prominent in blues. But, you know, and this is worth at least 3 or 4 PhD. How this, you know, you can see, oh, that's blue. No, it's not. So it's feasible that they were singing in a possible scale pattern that was, in fact, it just had a similar quality.
Right.
I'm beginning to think that if you trace the lineage of blues and ballad traditions, you would end up with a kind of a DNA molecule kind of spiral with all kinds of, you know, cross links and connections.
I guess that I was just going to get to Neil because Neil had a question as well.
Just one question, and that is, did Lomax collect any type of music or any of some of the very earliest workers up in the Kiva and off Cornish?
No. He did not. Most of what he collected, there was no Cornish. There could have been some cross-pluralization with Cornish somehow in the background of these individual performers. But Jim Leary has, in preparation for his 5-volume set, has been trying to find what he can from the family members about a lot of the individual performers. And it's predominantly in the Keweenaw, it was Finns and French Canadians. And then there were this one Croatian family from Amik and Masa further south, but yeah, right.
Cross-fertilization occurs all the time, including once media comes in or books and so on. For instance, Perry Allen, the great storyteller, Beck and Lomax work was clearly influenced by written Paul Bunyan stories. It's not clear whether you read them. Trying to trace I've tried to trace single things, like the Legend of the Sleeping Bear. I've got a 100 single page documentation trying to figure out this thing. all the cross-fertilization that goes into it. So you know, it's great that people want to try and find the connections, but actually doing it is difficult. I did want to point out that I was lucky enough in 1987 to interview Mr. Ellsworth, who was the youngest.
Oh, you did?
Lumberjacks.
Yeah.
He had not actually been a lumberjack. He had learned to play the fiddle, and he got added to the group, but he did go on the St. Louis.
I will say, just in terms of you know, various traditions in media and so forth interacting, what people of that era collecting were trying to do was what they thought was the pure oral tradition. Whether it was or not, you know, remains to be seen. I know from my own work, likely not, but there certainly was oral tradition that was influenced by print from the 19th century. On Beaver Island, you had a man from the island who was a caller on WLNS in Chicago, who's coming up and, you know, leading square dances on the island. You had all the people coming on the shipping lanes and stopping and bringing, you know, whatever. So there were Métis fiddlers on High Island, which I think may have influenced Pat Bonner, who was influenced by lumberjack and upper Midwest fiddling, I think by the Métis fiddling and by the Irish fiddling of the men that introduced him. So there's all sorts of cross-fertilization going on all the time.
Well, why don't we give Laurie another round of applause, please? Please come back for Love, Sex, and Greed when Marcy Ray is here talking about French comic opera. And we look forward to having you at other Our Daily Work, Our Daily Lives things. And thanks so much for coming. Do sign in if you haven't signed in.
If anybody would like, there were podcasts for the Library of Congress about Michigan and just the bibliography here, website. So if anybody wanted a copy, you're welcome to it.